Prepare to be astonished!
It's that time again.
Let's get started.
From the Clatsop County Historical Society, an adventure in history with Matt Burns and Alana Quila.
You should never be allowed to talk to people.
Some people without brains do an awful lot of talking.
And now, with today's adventure, it's Mac and Alana.
Good evening, and welcome to Adventures in History. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Seaside Hospital, here this evening with Mac Burns, Executive Director of the Clatsop County Historical Society.
And a special guest. Last week we had Jimmy, and this week we have Jim.
Yes.
So next week we're going to have somebody named James, I think. Jim Ahlberg, and you are a friend of the show. And we'll talk about your background a little bit, but just a quickie before we get started. You are a board member of the Clatsop County Historical Society. Thank you. You're an author. You're a retired banker and finance guy. And a direct descendant of?
Well, Captain John West, the founder of Westport. Yes, right.
So we might talk a little bit about Westport.
We might.
Right. Okay, that'd be good. I like that. Anything about Westport, I'm all for that.
Well, first, we have the big history highlights.
We do. Let's go for it.
So should we run through them really fast? Because this is going to be a great show.
Sure. And Jim, just so you know, it's the history highlights for tomorrow.
That's right.
Because it's Sunday night. So for Monday, these are the history highlights that you can take with you.
You can win money on Jeopardy or impress your friends that you know things.
Correct.
So here we go. 1587, Mary, Queen of Scots, is beheaded. And have you ever heard the story of this?
Well,
children, you should get out of the room now because it's a little graphic, but I like the graphic stuff. On February 8th, 1587, the doomed monarch was led into the great hall of Fotheringhay Castle, where a scaffold had been erected for the occasion, and the headsmen awaited. I love the name of the executioner is the headsmen.
Yeah, awful. Yeah,
it is awful. It's awful good. The gathered witnesses stood grimly as Mary presented herself and then laid her head on the block. With that, the executioner took a mighty swing with the axe. He missed.
Oh, my gosh.
The blow struck the back of her head instead of the neck. Witnesses reported that the stunned queen muttered, "Sweet Jesus!" before a second strike all but severed her head.
Oh my God.
The headsman, exasperated by his own incompetence, was forced to saw away the remaining sinew to finally finish the job.
Mac.
With an axe.
This is the last time I'm letting you do this without my proofing ahead of time.
Well, your daughter's not listening, right?
She is not.
Okay, good.
Oh my goodness.
And I did ask children to leave the room. Okay, but we're not done yet.
Last time, folks.
Alas, the ordeal wasn't over. After an execution, it was common practice to hold the head aloft to the witnesses. But when the headsman raised the queen's, it escaped his grasp and plopped to the floor. Mary had been wearing a wig, which was all that was left in the hapless executioner's hand. See, I kind of knew that she'd been beheaded, but I didn't know the story of it.
And you just so happened to look it up.
That's I did. This was one, usually I just kind of, oh, okay, and just the fact, and that's it. But this one, I don't know why, I looked it up. I thought, I need to know more about this. So,
well, now we all know, unfortunately.
That's right. On this day in 1725, Peter the Great dies. Mm-hmm. We need more people that have that in their name. And
right?
And at what point is he named Peter the Great? Do his parents name him that? and more importantly, then why didn't my parents name me Mac the Great?
Right.
Or it could have been worse, I suppose. Okay, 1904, the Russo-Japanese War starts with a surprise attack by the Japanese on the Russian Navy at Port Arthur. 1904, and yet we learn nothing from this. 1941.
Oh.
Okay. 1910, this was almost my history highlight of the day. The Boy Scouts of America is incorporated by William D. Boyce.
I saw that, yeah.
The Boy Scouts. Yay.
Now the Scouts.
Now the Scouts BSA or something
yes.
like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Good.
I don't know where the lawsuit is with the Girl Scouts suing them.
Oh, are they?
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Because when they decided to let girls in, it was kind of just a blatant, we're trying to grow our membership.
Well, sure. Right. I mean, line those pocketbooks. But they'd already were letting girls in. Right? Weren't they? Wasn't Eagle Scouts always?
No.
Oh,
there was a thing called Explorers.
Explorers. Okay.
For 14 and up that could be co-ed.
Got it.
But they never let the girls work on like Eagle Scout, the ranks
oh,
or anything
okay.
like that. They could just do some of the activities. So this was a big step forward.
Sure.
Okay. 1922, radio arrives at the White House. So now the president can listen to Adventures in History.
Exciting. With
Mac and Alana. 1922. But we weren't on the air yet. Okay, 1924. First execution by lethal gas in the U.S. is carried out in Nevada. It's all about executions today.
I know. It was grim when I was going through some of them.
1965, President Johnson deploys the first U.S. combat troops in South Vietnam with 3,500 Marines sent to protect the key U.S. air base near Da Nang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, of course, these weren't the first troops. These were the first combat troops. We had observers and helpers and CIA guys, and it actually goes back all the way to Kennedy and maybe a little before then, but... but our history highlight today, the thing that I think had the most impact on history, and not a good one, 1915, The Birth of a Nation, the movie, premieres. It's the first 12-reel film directed by T.D.W. Griffith. And the reason it has so much significance is because it was all about the Klan. And it made the Klan look good. And it kind of reinforced that it was okay to be racist.
Right. There's the... Pride there.
Yeah, so our history highlight today, not a good one.
Right.
But it had a big impact.
For sure.
Did I miss any?
You did miss one, and this is about another queen who did not lose her head. 1952, Elizabeth becomes Queen of England after her father, King George VI, dies.
Ooh, wow.
So, yeah.
Well, good for her.
That's a happier note to move on from.
But yes, a little something positive to move into something pretty positive as well.
Exactly.
So Jim, tell a little bit about who you are, the background of who you are before we get into Westport and some of the history.
Well, real quick, and it's interesting you talk about Mary Queen of Scots because, of course, she was born in Linlithgow Castle in Scotland, and Linlithgow is where Captain John West was born as well before he emigrated to Canada and then came.
It all ties together.
There. Yeah, so it's amazing. But anyway, I'm a fifth generation Oregonian and always have been interested in Oregon history, all history for that matter. And then, of course, the family ties to Westport caused me to work on a book. Took about 5 years. We did a book on Westport and then with the Clatsop County Historic Society's help. But
you jumped the gun a little bit.
Oh, I did.
And we're not going to spend a ton of time on this, although we could, because you've had a fascinating, interesting career.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Maybe fascinating. I don't think it was too fascinating, but but I was in banking for 27 years, and then one of my accounts was Fred Meyer Corporation, and they hired me as treasurer, and I was treasurer of Fred Meyer for about 27 years. Kroger, of course, buying us in 1999, and I went to work for Kroger as well. So I had a wonderful career with Fred Meyer and Kroger, too. Just fantastic companies to work for.
And you actually knew the guy, Fred Meyer, not just the company, but you were in board meetings with him. And
well, Fred Meyer and O.B. Robertson, yes, some of those gentlemen. I mean, very, very late. God, I'm trying to think the year he died, but he was still coming into the office, and Broadway Cab would bring him in. Eve, his wife, had passed away, and he would still come into the office, and he was in his 90s, 94, 95 years old, something close to that, and his secretary had taken his car keys away, but Broadway Cab brought him in every morning and with his cane, and he lived in an apartment downtown. He never owned a home. He had a large estate up in Welch's, where he liked to fly fish and those kind of things, and his ashes were put on that Salmon River up there by Welch's when he died. Well, fascinating.
Someday we'll have you come in and talk about Fred Meyer's story.
Yeah.
Because I don't think people realize. I mean, they go in there, they see the name on the store, Fred Meyer, but I don't think they really rationalize and know that there was a guy, and he was alive not terribly long ago.
Yeah, Fred Grubmeyer. Right. Fred G. Meyer. Fred Grubmeyer. Right. Quite a man.
So you are the great-great-great-great-grandson of Captain West. Five greats?
That's correct, yeah. Five greats. That's right.
And Westport, you know, when I first drove through Westport, I thought that it was Westport, like it was west of someplace. And I didn't realize there was a Captain West, and that's where the name comes from. So you talked about where he came from, but how did he get here, and how did he pick that town, and what did he do there to begin with?
Well, yeah, just real quick on him. He, of course, he's born in Scotland, and he came as in his teens, 17, 18 years old, to Nova Scotia, where a lot of the Scots came, of course, to Canada and Nova Scotia, and then settled in Quebec and learned the millwright trade there in Quebec and became a very, in the grist mills and large sawmills there on the St. Lawrence Freeway, or the St. Freeway, it's not a freeway, St. Lawrence Seaway, excuse me.
Well, it kind of was a freeway. Kind of,
well, it really is. These rivers are the freeways, aren't they? And then in 1849, he was doing well there, and he chartered a vessel, a sailing vessel, with goods and supplies to bring to the great gold rush in 49. He was not going there to be a gold miner. I think he was smart enough not to try that, but he thought he could sell goods there and things, and him and his brothers chartered a boat with a bunch of inventory and brought it all in 1849, and something went wrong down there. I don't know exactly what it was, but opportunities up here in Oregon for millwrights, and he was one of the first millwrights, and he came up here and built a couple sawmills for George Abernathy. I guess you would call him one of our first territorial governor, I guess, of sorts, not a governor of Oregon. He built some for them up by Prescott and Oak Point up there by Stella in that area. And then he found he had a donation land grant claim. He settled Westport and started packing salmon there and opened the first salmon canning operation on the, it'd be the Oregon side of the Columbia, not the first one on the lower Columbia, but the first one on the Oregon side, very successful in salmon. And then he had a water-powered mill on West Creek there, a sawmill. And then he built a steam-powered mill, and he did very, very well, much better on the salmon than he ever did on the timber operation and the logging and the sawmilling. But
and didn't he try like to try and use every ounce of the fish that he was looking at different things to
he
do?
He did, yeah. He was a very innovative guy. He really was. He invented a salmon canning process machine that was patented, and everybody kind of duplicated that. And but yeah, he'd use the oil from the fish, and he the meal and everything, and he actually then he started canning mutton and beef. He tried that. These were early years. This is 1868, 1869, and of course he won the big gold medal at the Agricultural Society, which was a precursor of the Oregon State Fair. That was a big deal, and his label still in existence today. The John Westwood label is still in existence out of Liverpool, England. And it's still one of the primary salmon canning and fish canning labels in the world. Very popular in England and Ireland and Canada, New Zealand, Australia, most of the British Commonwealth type countries, but not so much in the United States. But you do see it. Fred Meyer carries it on occasion, the John West label. But that is the John West.
And they recognize that the name of their line comes from this town, Westport, don't they?
Oh, they do. I went back and met with the West Foods people several occasions in Liverpool at their world headquarters. Their world headquarters now is actually it's in Thailand now. It's actually changed. Unilever owned it for a while, then Heinz Food bought it, and then another conglomerate bought it. But right now it's headquartered. But they still in Thailand, but they still have a big office there in Liverpool. And I visited with them. They treat us like royalty when we go back there and see them. It's a big deal.
As long as they don't cut your head off.
Right, yeah, right.
But you gave us, we've got on exhibit in our natural resources exhibit at the Heritage Museum, we've got the can of it, and we've got the gold medal, don't we?
That's right. That's right. The original gold medal from the Agricultural Society of Oregon before the State Fair, yeah. And he used it on all his labels. He was smart enough to say, well, this is a big deal, so we'll put this on all our canning labels. And we have the collection of all the canning labels here, the originals going to 1868 to 1878. And then the run started to decline quite a bit there. I mean, I don't know how many canneries there were on the Lower Columbia, but there was a lot there in the 1870s and 80s, I think.
How amazing. And so how long did he continue to do that business?
Well, he continued to do that business until he died in 1888.
Oh, my goodness.
He died in his early 80s in 1888. And then his son took over, David, and not disparaging anything against him, but he just wasn't his father, as innovative as his father, and things pretty much dissipated there. The mill, he sold the mill, he sold most of the town, and then the big Westport Lumber Company was formed by Myron Woodard and his partners, and that became the big mill there. But that's a whole other story. That's from another book. That's a whole other come tuck. So go buy the book.
It's the second generation always blows it.
lots of the times.
If it actually survives the second generation, then the third generation is the one that makes it grow again.
Right.
So yeah, you've written or referenced a couple of books you've written for us, and I would say very generously gave us all the rights to it and all the profit from it. So when people bought those books, either the Westport or the Company Towns of Clatsop County, you didn't make any money on that at all.
It cost you a lot, but it was worth it.
But we still have one of those books on our shelf for people to purchase. But you've written a bunch of articles for Cumtux, and actually what I thought about bringing in for today was you wrote one a couple of months ago about the ferry.
Right.
And of course, usually when Astoria talks about the ferry, they think of the ferry here from Astoria across to Megler, but the still operating. And is it the last operating?
This Westport Ferry is the last operating ferry on the lower Columbia. There are two other ferries. Depends on how you kind of slice and dice this fact. There are two other ferries still operating up in Washington on the Columbia River, but those ferries do not cross into Oregon, so they're not interstate ferries. Mm-hmm. This is the only ferry on the Columbia River that passes between Oregon and Washington, and the only ferry that is interstate ferry west of the Mississippi River. So,
and it was quite busy. Was it like 2 weeks ago when we had a landslide or a mudslide? And that was, I saw some people, that was the main mode of transportation instead of going all the way back or waiting. They took the ferry.
That's exactly right. I mean, it ties into the whole concept of the beginning of the ferry. I mean, the river, because all these river towns on the lower Columbia, I mean, the highway was the river. I mean, that was it. That's how you communicate with the outside world. And of course, there's always been a long tie between Cathlamet and Westport, going back to the two Scotsmen, John West, we talked about Scotsmen, and the other one was James Burney of the retired from the Hudson Bay Company, who had a trading post in Cathlamet. And so they were friends and acquaintances and things, and John West would go over there in the early 1850s and get supplies and goods from the trading coast. So there's always that connection between Cathlamet and Westport. And yeah, and it's interesting you say how busy that ferry is. I when I was doing my research, I was working with the officials there in Cathlamet or in Wakayakum County, that of course own and operate the ferry along with the state. And in 2019, that little ferry, and I was amazed at this. Of course, I don't know if I should be or not, but 83,000 passengers in 2019.
That's astounding.
And 45,000 vehicles were on that ferry. I mean, I was stunned at that. Myself.
I think that's amazing.
I know.
Because it's kind of small.
Yeah, it's kind of small. But
what, like 14 cars?
Right, that's a lot of trips.
Something like that, 12?
Yeah, yeah. So there is that connection. And you're right. I mean, back then, the only way to get, well, they had a ferry earlier. And of course, here in Astoria, it was earlier from Astoria to Migler. But in about 1920, a guy by the name of I forget all these names because all these names blur together as I write these articles. But Coates, Walter Coates, had two ferries built in Portland. Beautiful ferries. There's of course pictures in the Cumtux of those, and all the original photographs and everything are here in the archives. We've given all of those, so there's much more research. All the research, all the research is here and available to everybody. There's much more to this story than just this article. I mean, we cut a lot of things out, but there's lots of facts and all newspaper articles and tons of photographs. And anyway, he had these two ferries built, the Cathlamet and the Westport ferries in 1925 to make the connection. And one would go, of course, from Cathlamet to Puget Island. And then the other one would go from Puget Island to Westport. And then he had a road built across down about 3.5 mile road. And he had a Buick, big Buick town car that would drive people back and forth and the crews. And then later there was a Studebaker bus he got from one of the hotels in Portland, and he ran that, and he ran it for a long time, and then he sold the two ferries.
And what was the business? I mean, who were the people? Were they workers at the mill in Westport or Wanamill later? Or
I mean, the passengers was interesting when you go back there and you think about it. Of course, there was trade between there. There was the ferry at in Astoria, and then also up in Longview, they had a ferry. The Long Bell Lumber Company had a ferry, small ferry operation run over to Rainier, until they built the bridge there. But the, yeah, the passengers were, I mean, Puget Island, there's quite a few people on Puget Island. They would take the ferry. This, all the children there would go to school in Westport, so they come over there. The mill workers were drawing workers from, well, from the Washington side and Puget Island for the Bradwood Mill, the Big Wanna Mill, the Big Westport Mill. So there's activity there. I mean, entertainment was there in Westport with the movie theater, the bowling alley, the pool hall, and other activities, shopping and things. And so there's passengers there. And they had funeral processions. We got pictures of funeral processions on the ferry because most of the people on Puget Island and many of the people, even though Kathlamet has a Pioneer Cemetery as well, we're buried at the Westport Cemetery. It was a bigger cemetery, and we have these funeral cars going across on these ferries in the old days to bring people that passed away on Puget Island and things. So
I love the image of going to Westport for the entertainment. And that's the problem, is that our view of Westport today is just this sleepy little spot to get some pie or to get some gas,
right,
and
yeah,
maybe to pick up the ferry and
they
across.
Had that, yeah, they had that huge 4L hall there, which later became, they called the clubhouse. And boy, it had a pool room and library, beautiful dance hall in it, and stage and orchestra and dining facilities, a library, a barbershop, steam laundry, beauty salon, on and on. So it was, it was the metropolis up there in that end of the county.
That's amazing. So we're talking with Jim about Jim Alberg about Westport and the ferry there. Let's take a little break, and we'll be right back on An Adventure in History.
February 9th, 1889. To be or not to be, asks the lonely Dane. A sea of troubles opposed, he shrank before them, ambition lay dead. Life, as he viewed it, rested under a yellow cloud tinged with green. Hamlet, to my mind, was bilious. The blood diseased, carried through the natural gates and alleys of the body, made life a burden, and the ills of the body magnified in tenfold degrees his other ills. Purify the blood, give new life and action to the system. Take Dr. Pierce's Golden Medical Discovery, and your drowsiness, lack of appetite, chilly sensation, yellow skin, bad breath will depart as the morning mists are dispelled by the rising sun. Thousands of cures follow the use of Dr. Sage's Cutter recipe. 50 cents.
And welcome back to An Adventure in History. I'm Alana Quila with Providence Eastside Hospital, here tonight with Mac Burns, Clatsop County Historical Society. And we are here with Jim, talking about your ties to Westport. And tell us a little bit about your story. Where did you grow up? And why are you still here?
I was actually born and raised in Pendleton, Oregon. I was grew up in Heppner, Oregon, Eastern Oregon. My parents owned a bakery up there, and so no hospital in Heppner, so we drive the 80 miles to be delivered there in Pendleton. I and my brothers, and my mom didn't care for Eastern Oregon, the wind and the dust and things, so she kind of said, we're moving to Portland. So anyway, so I grew up in Portland, went to school in Portland, and high school in Portland, Portland State University. So yeah, a native here, clearly.
And clearly you like history, but you went into to finance, probably because you didn't think history could be a career of any kind. But were you always aware of this connection to Westport? I mean, did the family talk about that, or is that something you discovered later?
Yeah, the great aunts and the great uncles and the grandmothers talked about it, and I picked up little bits and pieces there. But it was fascinated with history, and then you started the process of really uncovering all this stuff, and I still spend countless hours doing it. I'm finding something new all the time, and then I joined the board of the Oregon Historical Society, and I was on that for quite a while, and then I've always had a connection here, going way back with my research with Lisa Penner. God, it must go back 30-plus years or more, and I love it, and we have a home here, in Clatsop County, and have had a second home here, which will become our primary home here shortly, so in Warrington.
And you've written not only the two books for us, but four or five, six articles for Cumtux, five articles.
Yeah.
And those are all still available. The Westport book, we had to actually print it twice, and we've sold out of that one.
Right.
But the Company Towns book is still available, although we're getting down there. And it's amazing that you've done this research and documented, again, which people like me, newcomers, we don't understand that this history was so rich and so huge, and they were sending things around the world, not just the salmon, but logs around the world.
Oh, yeah, the lumber. Yeah, we have a list of all of the vessels, the major vessels. They started with sailing ships, of course, and barks and barkentines, the sailing vessels, and then the steamships, and then the big, huge motor ships. And we have a list of every ship that ever called on Westport, and we know where it went, the value of the cargo, and all over the world. Yeah, all over the world.
Well, even just the legacy of the seafood canning. I mean, that's just so big for this area. Even my husband's family was in that business, so skipping on brand seafood, their own cannery. The last one on the North Oregon coast, other than Bell Buoy, to exist. And then to hear, to be in this room, and, you know, your relative started the first one down here.
Down here. And still in. And the still name going. Is still there. Yeah. The longest canning label in the history, period. Nowhere in the world would there be a longer existing canning, salmon canning label than John West Foods.
And right here in Clatsop County and being sent all around the world. No. That's the most amazing thing. And then, of course, like the old Ironsides connection. I love that story.
Oh, from Westport. Yeah. Westport had that special head rig that had an extended trailer on it, so they could cut the big timbers. And the only place they could find master for the restoration of the old Ironsides, the Constitution, was the Westport Mill, and they supplied them and then shipped them all back to Boston Naval Yard, and they were assembled and put there. And then, of course, the Constitution came out here on one of its runs and anchored off of Westport.
As a thank you to Westport,
didn't it? Yeah. And also anchored here in Astoria. We have lots of photographs of when the Constitution came here.
So you've been researching lograffs, and that's another show. And we've got some cool footage that you've uncovered that someday we'll have a lecture and actually let people see the footage. The lograffs, though, can you in about a minute just talk about the significance of that?
Yeah, the massive lograffs, they call them the Benson lograffs or the Benson cigar lograffs. So, And I wrote an article in the Cumtux. It's really a fascinating article. It really gets down on all the numbers and how this all worked. And we did uncover some film of these 16-millimeter films. We've had it all restored. The society here has had it all restored. It's from Eric Evenson of Evenson Logging in Klaskanine. It's his family. It goes way back in Benson Timber. And we're actually the owners of Benson Timber. Benson actually had sold out. And really, there's a big entrepreneur out of... San Diego, and the Evensons really ran the whole operation. And this film is this is just making these cradles where they put the rafts together in these cradles in Wallace Slough, and then they moved it over to close to Cathlamet, and they built them there. And we have film of this, and it'll just blow you away when you see this. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
And those log rafts left here and went to San Francisco and to San Diego?
San Diego. Okay. Those are all San Diego to the mill that they built down there just to process these logs. And we have them coming in around Point Loma in San Diego showing these log rafts going in there. They used to go in there. When they first went in there, they tore up all the underground telephone lines and power lines. So blacked out most San Diego when they first brought them in. But they figured that out later.
It's amazing.
It is. Great story. Thank you, Jim. Jim Allberg.
We will have to have you back.
Yes.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Have a great day, everyone. Great evening.
Great evening and a great week. And go make some history. We'll catch you next week. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for joining us for An Adventure in History. An Adventure in History is created and produced by the Clatsop County Historical Society and brought to you by KMUN.